Hi, this is Lisa Costabile. Join us on FX Medicine next week, where I'll be talking to Dr. Brad Leach about intestinal inflammation, including testing and treatment in clinical practice. Subscribe to us on your favourite podcast app and follow us on social media to make sure you never miss an episode. Hi, and welcome to FX Medicine, where we bring you the latest in evidence-based, integrative, functional, and complementary medicine. FX Medicine acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia, where we live and work, and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respect to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. Joining us on the line today is Todd Mansfield, otherwise known as the Byron Herbalist. Todd is a herbalist specialising in gastrointestinal health with a strong interest in small intestinal fungal overgrowth, irritable bowel syndrome, SIBO, inflammatory bowel disease, candida overgrowth, and environmental mould exposure. Welcome to FX Medicine, Todd.
Hello, Lisa. Happy to be here.
I've been wanting to talk about fungal overgrowth for such a long time, so it's such a delight to have you here. Now, we're delving into the world of all things fungal overgrowth and its far-reaching effects on the gut specifically. Now, when it comes to gut complaints and the gut microbiome, most practitioners are aware of the bacterial component and we focus a lot there. However, we also have a microbiome, which is the term used to describe the fungal component of our gut. Now, while the microbiome is much smaller in diversity and abundance than the bacterial component, we know it's just as important because dysbiosis of the microbiome has been implicated in a range of gut complaints, including small intestinal fungal overgrowth, bloating, diarrhea, and even autoimmune conditions such as celiac disease, which we all have patients with. So let's start by maybe talking about the fungus in our gut, and you can tell us a little bit more about it, including its role.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I find that the kind of fungal side of things have been massively kind of maybe under-researched and underappreciated. Mm. This took me definitely a few years. I was doing a lot of work with SIBO and focusing on kind of microbiome restoration. Again, mainly focusing on the bacterial balance. And a bunch of patients would get better, like a whole heap of them, maybe 80, 90% of patients. And there were always those stumper patients that, you know, any clinician who's listening to this will know. Those ones that make you kind of push into new fields. What have we missed? You know, stones that we haven't looked under. And have found that the fungal overgrowth side of things has been a major, major driver, particularly for those chronically unwell patients and extreme symptoms as well. And so when I'm kind of assessing a new patient, look, it sounds like SIBO, which I'm sure your audience has, you know, kind of been covered on and educated on. Mm. But the symptoms are extreme. Mm. So look, it might be a little bit more of that fungal overgrowth side of things. So, I mean, today we're going to be talking a lot about candida because that's the bulk of the literature. We don't really have a lot of literature and science on a lot of the other fungal overgrowths. But I've been seeing a lot of fungal, a lot of candida, little bit of geotrichum, little bit of rhodotorula on lab testing. Mm. And the big mama, like the real problem that is just totally being overlooked and missed, doesn't happen often. I might see maybe five patients a month with it, would be aspergillosis. Mm. So actually green mold colonizing and growing in the body. It's a real problem. We're going to dive into some mechanisms of action and all the kind of ways we can help support those patients.
Okay, I can't wait. So with regards to fungi, I think a lot of the times when I have patients coming to see me, they're like, oh my God, I've got fungal overgrowth, eradicate, eradicate, eradicate. But to an extent, like some of it, candida is commensal, right? It's meant to be there.
Big time. Yeah. And we see the really big one. So I got a little bit of extra education kind of preparing for today because we don't normally see people that are well. So we're looking a lot of kind of like the disease and the dysbiosis and the imbalances. We see people that are unwell, obviously, you and me. and any clinician listening. But looking into this, you see a lot of the kind of commensal actions of the microbiome. Mm-hmm. I think the really kind of glaringly obvious piece here is that in healthy mothers' milk, they're passing on a lot of fungal overgrowth. A lot of fungal species in that milk, similar to the bacterial kind of transfer from mum to bubs. You see that a lot in mother's milk, in the mode of delivery, kind of peaks at around, infant age, drops off at the adult age. And then as people move into the elderly years, it starts to become a little bit more simple, a little bit reduced on that load.
That's fascinating. So, the benefits of breastfeeding and delivery mode and so on, it really does influence not just the bacterial microbiome, but the fungal too. Really, really interesting. So what are the sorts of signs and symptoms someone might present with that has fungal overgrowth? And maybe we break this up into sections of the GIT, starting with that oral microbiome.
Sure. Yeah, the big one, and I think it's kind of important. And again, a lot of this is Candida literature. And, even when we do testing, Candida comes back as the kind of primary driver. Mm. And again, you're mentioning as a commensal, it's growing there. And so anytime you get disruptions to the microbiome, which we're going to talk about, or the immune system, kind of gives a little bit of more real estate for Candida to take over. Mm. So we can see it is oral thrush. Seen a bunch of esophageal candidiasis or esophageal thrush. So common that vulvo-vaginal candidiasis, vaginal thrush. Seeing a lot in the gut as well. Don't see a whole lot of candida in the lungs, but I definitely have treated a few patients with aspergillosis, green mold growing in the lungs. Mm. It's a real problem. Mm. And then a bunch of other places, you see it in the sinuses, the biliary tract, which is new to me. There's no real way to kind of sample that, so you'd never know. Mm. And we got the skin. Yeah. You see a lot kind of nails on the hands and feet.
Yeah.
Those are the kind of primary sites that you see it. Mainly the sinuses and the gut, vaginal as well. Rare to see it in the mouth and the esophagus as an overgrowth.
Yeah, so the esophagus is really interesting. I see it a lot, obviously, when we're getting our patients to stick out the tongue and looking at the coating on the tongue, we'll see it there. But I had a patient with Hashimoto's who had been diagnosed with reflux, and she was getting that discomfort around that esophagus area, and she ended up going to have an endoscopy, and she'd been prescribed proton pump inhibitors. What they actually found was an overgrowth of candida that was causing her symptoms, and it wasn't, a reflux issue at all. So I thought that was really, really interesting.
Yeah, big time. Yeah, and I'd also be looking at the link. Again, we're kind of way ahead of the literature, which I think, as clinicians, we have to do. But I'd be looking at links between like esophageal candidiasis and eosinophilic esophagitis as well. Mm. So like, what's that immune? The immune system's kind of calling the eosinophils to the esophagus there. I'd be curious if fungal overgrowth or imbalance was a driver with some of those patients.
Definitely. So we've talked about some of those symptoms that people might present with and the signs, but what about the systemic symptoms? Because people often complain about things like brain fog and so on.
Huge. Yeah, that's really, really big. So the big kind of, if we're talking digestive symptoms, they kind of mimic SIBO, and that's pretty hard to kind of tease them out. You have to do a little bit of testing, which we'll talk about today. We get the bloating, the change in bowel movements, gas, those are all really common. Nausea is a major, major symptom of SIFO, that overgrowth in the small bowel. And then if you're kind of broadening it out a little bit more towards the systemic symptoms, I see a lot of brain fog. Can talk a little bit about that, whether that's acetaldehyde, whether that's ammonia production. I see a lot of body pain that could be tied to certain fungal overgrowth, definitely candida and definitely aspergillus, their ability to produce oxalates. And that's a whole it's an absolute rabbit hole that we could spend this whole conversation talking about. But it's such a significant pathway, the glycoxylate pathway, that they're actually developing antifungal drugs to target that enzyme that Candida uses, isocitrate lyase, to produce oxalates. So you see a lot of joint pain, a lot of body pain, a lot of muscle kind of pain as well. All the kind of oxalate symptoms, those are really big too.
That's wild that they can, that Candida can do that. So how does something then that is a commensal turn into essentially like the problem child? You mentioned the pathophysiology a little bit. Can you take us a little bit deeper?
Yeah, this is really huge. Again, because if you look at the microbiome in general and kind of even the ancestral lens, we're talking about like diversity and balance. Like a balanced, diverse ecosystem occupies all these niches and kind of keeps these invaders, this switch from kind of commensal to less friendly, bugs, fungal, bacterial, whatever. Not so much parasites. Maybe parasites. We'll talk about that later. But the big shift there that I see all the time is like a damage to the microbiome. So it's an opening in the niche, and then Candida for sure, definitely it'll make this switch from the unicellular yeast form that's more associated with, as a commensal, not an issue, to this pseudo-hyphal, hyphal variety. And you can go deep on this. They've found that it actually has this sense of touch when it kind of like almost germinates and grows. And just picture like mycelium. It's probably the wrong way to picture it.
No, I know what you mean, because it's kind of like they've got these rooty things, right, coming out of them, and they just sucking on, like they transform and become these like suckers that invade.
Right.
Yeah, it's wild. So basically saying the commensal, they transform into like a more pathogenic type.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's associated with gut damage. It's associated with biofilm formation. Mm. We're still unclear. This kind of drives me a bit nuts, but depends on who you read. Some researchers are saying that Candida can form, produce mycotoxins.
Yes.
But there's totally, we've looked at 10 different strains and it hasn't produced any gliotoxin. Mm. Definitely Aspergillus, that's a major producer of mycotoxins. And I think that's why, among a bunch of these other things that we're going to talk about today, but I think that's why the severity of presentation is, so much more compared to your typical dysbiosis, the IBS presentation, or like a mild to moderate form of SIBO, like the SIFO, fungal overgrowth in the small bowel, the aspergillosis pictures. They're the patients frequently that have been unwell for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, sometimes their whole life.
Yeah.
And they're like, I don't know what's going on. I've done everything under the sun. I haven't found a good reason why, and I haven't found a treatment to get me better.
Yeah. So do you think, because it sounds like, I know it they tend to be, it's a chronic condition. And often because they think they might have had SIBO and so on, they've been prescribed lots and lots of antibiotics. And we know the side effect of killing all that bacteria is fungal overgrowth. And so I wonder what comes first. Was the fungal overgrowth already there? And then the antibiotics make everything worse and so on. Mm-hmm. It's hard to know.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And the other really big one, again, just to piggyback on the antibiotics, is that's a really kind of big clinical pearl. If someone takes antibiotics and they feel worse, antibiotics are doing a bunch of other kind of nasty things, damaging the mitochondria and disrupting, beneficial balance, lowering or limiting butyrate production. It's a bunch of kind of less beneficial things that antibiotics do.
Mm.
But a really kind of big key would be even something like, maybe not so much rifaximin, but definitely more of these broad spectrum antibiotics. I felt so much worse on antibiotics. Mm-hmm. I'd be starting to suspect that the fungal overgrowth piece was playing a role in that patient.
Mm. And I also wonder with that, because with the research, with the SIBO research, they get better for a while, but then it comes back. And I wonder, the symptoms come back. And I wonder if part of that is the fungal overgrowth manifesting itself too.
Yeah, bigger picture. Mm. I have a, maybe speaking to kind of patients, trying to simplify it a bit, my answer to that would be you haven't actually resolved the SIBO root cause. I kind of look at SIBO more as a symptom now than, I mean, obviously it's a condition, but there's something has broken down. And same thing with SIFO too, but something has broken down in your body's ability to regulate and balance the small bowel. And then, you know, bacteria, or in the case of methane, archaea overgrow. So when it regresses, which is common, it's not uncommon, it's a, oh, look, we haven't dealt with, you know, low stomach acid, motility, or, you know, adhesions or something.
Yeah. So are those, I was going to ask you, like, what are the common causes of small intestinal fungal overgrowth? And so far, we've kind of chatted about antibiotics, and then you just said low stomach acid. What else?
Yeah. So the big ones, any disruption to the microbiome. So, I mean, definitely not the patients that I treat, because they're all very health conscious, most of them. Very poor kind of, you know, high carb diets, or the refined kind of carbs, and don't have a problem with complex carbs for most people, depending on the patient. But again, anything kind of disrupting that ecosystem, clearing out space, antibiotics would be huge. And then a massive, massive piece, again, that gets overlooked is any dysfunction of the immune system. And so this comes back to why I think it's under-recognized. I had a patient, we did a test that we'll talk about today, and it was like off the charts for fungal overgrowth and for oxalates. And I was like, this is explains everything. And then he was talking to his doctor and said, oh, you know, talk about candida. She says, oh, that was so kind of like 1990s diagnosis. And so it's really fallen out of favor.
Yeah.
And thankfully, SIFO is kind of, you know, re-sparking that interest in fungal overgrowth.
Yeah. So it is funny because candida used to be all the rage when I was at uni a long time ago. And but we are seeing that it actually is a thing. It's not a fatty sort of thing where you do an anti-candida diet. Like, candida overgrowth is a major thing, but understanding the underlying driver and understanding what's going on with the host, I think, is really what is the big deal, isn't it? That compromised host. So do you see a lot of patients with autoimmunity that have small intestinal fungal overgrowth? Because certainly within the literature, they're showing that there's a high incidence with children that have celiac disease and any sort of inflammatory bowel, Crohn's, and definitely with Hashimoto's. I see lots of patients with fungal overgrowth.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's huge. And I think it's because it's a bit more, it just impacts more broadly on kind of host physiology, so your body, right? So rather than being like this localized dysbiosis, and definitely bacterial dysbiosis and like endotoxins and LPS, that 100% impacts kind of your whole body. But I feel like the reach of a fungal overgrowth can be so much more systemic. And the more severe it gets and the more dug in it gets, you know, here we can talk about things like biofilm formation. It is like the fourth. It is the fourth. It's not like the fourth. It is the fourth most common hospital-acquired infection, candida. And that's because it forms these biofilms, in part because it forms these biofilms on medical instruments, which makes it very hard to shift.
Wow.
Very hard to treat. Yeah, exactly.
So a biofilm, is that kind of like a coating, a protective shell or something like that?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the way I kind of think about it. I'm very kind of like visual in my understanding. It's probably always wrong. But I picture like these shields around these. It's not always fungal. I mean, you can have these co-residents, and the more developed these biofilms become, the more treatment resistant and the more like three-dimensional they become. It's kind of them going into a bit of hibernation. And so a lot of the things that we'll talk about today when we talk about treatment can disrupt biofilms. And that is a good thing and a bad thing. On the bad side, it can really kind of like, it's like opening Pandora's box. You're cracking open something that's been laying semi-dormant, and then the immune system has to get involved, inflammation, you know, that's the die-off piece that I see which is a huge symptom. That's another pearl with fungal overgrowth like SIFO. If you put someone on, say, like a SIBO protocol, which is antifungal, if we're talking about herbs, you see a huge amount of die-off in a lot of them.
So they will feel like more brain foggy, more bloated and fatigued and that sort of stuff. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, big time. They feel so much worse. It's almost like, you know, two steps back and you say, look, for me, and there's different approaches. I'd love to hear your take on this. But my take is if you're experiencing die-off, it's a good thing because we're using the right tools to address the problem. But it means that we're pushing it too hard.
Yes.
So take a weekend off, get back down to baseline, and then restart the program at a lower dose.
I like that. I don't know too much about this, so that's why I'm so excited to have you on on the line to really pick your brains, because I'm actually so gentle when I do anything like this. I'm a baby. If I have any sort of die-off symptoms, I'm like, oh no, I'm stopping. I don't want to do this anymore.
Right.
So,
yeah. Stop the program.
Okay, so you've talked a little bit about the testing, and I'm dying to know more because I don't know anything about testing for candida. Like, obviously, I know vaginal testing, but we're really talking about the gut today. So tell me everything.
Big time. That's right. So if we're talking, and you know, hopefully that was a good disclaimer at the start, like we're ahead of the literature right now and, you know, really being motivated by the patients that don't get better. So for me, I'm a clinician, number one. That's what I that's what I do. And my job is to get my patients better, support them in regaining their health as safely and as effectively, as quickly, and then if we could do it cheaply, I mean, that's just icing on the cake. So, you know, if we're looking at the literature, you know, the diagnosis of SIFO would be a duodenal aspirate and culture. And you see that the same, I'm sure you guys have covered a heap of SIBO. You see that the same with SIBO. I say, oh, look, the gold standard is a duodenal aspirate and culture. No one. I've never seen, I've maybe one patient in my whole career has ever had that done. It's too invasive. It's too expensive. It's not a great gold standard. And so we're left kind of looking for other answers there. And the answer that changed my practice, it's literally unrecognizable now from what it was before I started running them, would be organic acids testing. How much have you been using that at all?
No, never. Okay. So is that a stool test?
That's a urine test, actually.
Yeah.
So it's pretty wild. I mean, the two kind of criticisms that I see being kind of levied against oat testing, organic acids testing, would be, you know, the fact that it's kind of non-specific. So it's not actually going to tell you, drill down like DNA-based stool testing, the specific species that we're dealing with. And then the other issue that I see, you know, people who are criticizing this approach is, you know, it's unreliable, it's not accurate. And I can understand what they're saying. If we're kind of looking at individual markers, most oat tests would have somewhere between 70 to 100 different markers. To me, you know, once you actually learn how to interpret it, which is the whole journey, it's looking at, it's very complicated. You look at the story that the oat test is telling you. And so if you see high fungal markers, if you see high oxalate markers, if you see issues with nutrient depletion, you know, B2 is a huge one that I see all the time. And then elevated ammonia, decreased glutathione. That's the whole story. And these patients told you that when you first saw them before they did the oat test. But then you actually have something to lean on when treatment isn't kind of going as planned and say, look, this is what we're trying to get on top of. So we need to, you know, pivot rather than drop this approach and go looking for another problem.
Okay. And so they just do a urine sample, you send that off, and then you get the results of, like, it's like a culture of all the different things?
Oh, no, they're looking at kind of like, yeah, they're looking at organic acids, basically. Mm. So they're kind of like metabolites of, you know, so a lot, some of the metabolites are our own kind of biochemical metabolites. I mean, a really big one would be, that everyone knows about, would be methylmalonic acid, right? So if you're testing
B12. I haven't heard of that one.
Oh, no way. Okay, interesting. Okay, cool. This might be a little bit more American. I don't know. Yeah, cool. So B12, like you've got all the transcobalamin and serum B12.
Now you're talking about language.
Serum B12 is terrible. Oh, sorry, I cut you off. Yeah, sorry.
Oh, no, I was like, now I understand.
Totally. But it's a great, methylmalonic acid is a really good kind of, you know, explanation on how organic acids work, a bit more nuanced. But like serum B12, woefully inaccurate. Mm. Like I just don't even really look at it. I don't think it tells us anything. Hollow transcobalamin, that's great. If you can get a doctor to order it, it's pretty darn accurate. Mm. Methylmalonic acid will catch a B12 deficiency way ahead of those two. Mm. And it's got a lot to do with, you know, entries into the Krebs cycle and energy production, a lot around adenosylcobalamin rather than the other few B12s. Mm.
Okay. So you mentioned B2, vitamin B2 is quite a common deficiency that you see on the organic acids test. What does that mean in regards to, what does that tell you about the fungal overgrowth?
Yeah, I see B2 deficiencies with fungal overgrowth. Now, it's not all them, and that's the big thing, right? So you look at the global pattern, and then the other big piece, just to tie a bow in the last little conversation, is treatment. Mm. So you put someone on an antifungal program and they come back. I've seen this, like no movement for years. And then you get them on a strong antifungal program for a month and they come back and they're like, I've seen 80% improvements in these chronic debilitated cases. Mm. But B2, yeah, riboflavin. So you do see that. This definitely gets off into the weeds around biochemistry, but all of these cofactors that power these enzymes, you think what load, and that's the kind of, you know, broad conversation we're talking about now, what load on the body is a fungal overgrowth going to place on, and you see B2 as a cofactor for the methylation MTHFR, it's a massive one. And then the other really big one is part of the histamine breakdown, monoamine oxidase from memory, don't quote me on that. But the big one there, and I didn't mention this, this is huge, 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 massive systemic symptoms of histamine intolerance, nasal congestion, headaches, sore lymph nodes, rashes. Rashes are massive, massive, massive in certain fungal overgrowth pieces. And definitely, you've got the bacteria that can actually produce histamine in the gut. Candida is, we've got so much data on this. It is a mast cell trigger. It will cause your mast cells to degranulate and liberate all these pro-inflammatory cytokines and histamine. And then your body's trying to, you know, catch up, process all that histamine out of the system, depleting all that B2. And then you wind up with a deficiency and histamine symptoms because of a fungal overgrowth.
Wow. So fungal overgrowth causes mast cell degranulation and that subsequent release of histamine. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, one of many. If you're dealing with mast cell, do you treat any mast cell patients?
I do, but mostly, again, taking it back to the autoimmune thyroid like I always do, but it's such a common presentation, the rashes and that excessive histamine that thyroid patients often get. And they don't know why they're breaking out like that. And I always link it back to the dysregulated immune system. But I definitely know with Hashimoto's, there is a T helper 17 dysregulation implicated in Hashis. But the T helper 17 cells also function to prevent fungal overgrowth and bacterial too. So when those T helper 17 cells are disrupted, that it kind of drives that Hashis and that fungal overgrowth. So I'm thinking about a similar thing as you, but in a different kind of mechanism of action, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. Checking it. Exactly. Yeah. It's all kind of those pieces.
Yes.
I think it was just overwhelming for someone sitting in front of you with all these issues. But the big one is, for me, it's form a hypothesis, get some data. I think the longer if someone's been unwell for longer than a year, we're spending money on labs because it's going to get them better faster rather than just, you know, my clinical kind of intuition and, you know, what they think is going on. And then a huge piece is history. So if you talked about, you know, I mean, you were just talking about immune dysregulation, fungal overgrowth galore, antibiotics. I mean, I'm a child of the 80s and the 90s. They were handing out antibiotics like candy back then.
Gosh, it's so good that we now know better. And I was actually reading research at the weekend which was saying that we often worry about them in regards to the bacteria component of our guts, and we know that those effects can go on for more than, you know, 18, 19 months. But actually the fungal component of our gut is even more affected by the effects of antibiotics. So I think
interesting. As in like a bloom, a growth, and an over...
fungal dysbiosis, yeah.
Yeah, big time. And then we won't get off in the weeds too much on the bacteria piece, but I've seen this huge bloom of these pro-inflammatory, mainly the proteobacteria phylum, blooming after antibiotics, you know, pre and post testing. And they took antibiotics in between, and massive amounts of Klebsiella and Citrobacter and, you know, just all these really pro-inflammatory bugs. So they kind of don't do what they we're told that they do.
Yeah.
If you need them, you need them. But if we can avoid them, it's definitely better downstream.
Absolutely. So we've talked about the pathophysiology and all the, I guess, the things that can increase risk and so on. But how about management strategies? Because I feel like treating fungal overgrowth and fungal dysbiosis, it's quite complex. Often we're getting these patients that have had it for such a long time. They've tried all these different things and they've usually just had this reductionist approach in terms of prescribing of just antifungals, which based on what we've just been talking about, we really have to be thinking about the host immune status. Tell me about tell us about your approach for small intestinal fungal overgrowth.
Yeah, absolutely. So number one, and this is the kind of like holistic approach that we all do in natural medicine, is kind of treat the patient where they're at and where they're kind of coming to you. And so I'm always surprised, like candida and fungal overgrowth in general, patients can turn up with loose watery bowel movements, and then a really common one, particularly with aspergillosis and the mold exposure in the environment, which is a whole other can of worms. You see a lot of dysmotility, see a lot of breakdown in the ability to move things through the gut.
Is that constipation or just diarrhea?
Constipation, incomplete bowel movements, slow motility. You know, even if they're having a bowel movement every day, incomplete. I mean, my definition of constipation is a lot stricter than something you'd read in the literature. So, oh, if you have a bowel movement every 2 or 3 days, you're fine.
Yes.
Like, absolutely not. You need to be having a bowel movement every day. If you're not, that's the first priority.
Yeah.
And if you try and address some of these, you know, stronger approaches that we'll talk about now without the bowels moving properly, that's when I see a lot of the die-off symptoms being a lot more severe. Your number one detox channel is blocked. And then you do see a lot, again, those skin issues. It starts expressing these things through the skin in terms of like rashes and dermatitis and eczema. Psoriasis is big enough to make that connection.
That makes such sense. If those elimination channels are blocked, that it's going to come out through the skin too.
Big time. So big ones, I mean, like foundation protocol, if we're looking at like, I like looking big picture. And again, that's why I think I like the OAT test so much, because it's like, it's not telling you, yep, it's this, yep, it's that. It's like, what's the big picture? Where has the biochemistry kind of broken down? And how does that explain, you know, the symptoms of the patient you're working with? And so if we go kind of, you know, big picture, I think good, strong stomach acid is huge. We've got some data where candida can even resist the stomach acid.
Apparently it's normal. Apparently a little bit is normal in the gut, like in the stomach, but not too much.
That's obviously. Right, just a little bit. Yeah, yeah, the Goldilocks kind of idea. And again, I think that's why you see a lot of overgrowth of candida with PPI users.
Yes.
So people that are, you know, are drug-based suppressing their stomach acid. You see these overgrowth and issues. The other huge one that I see being overlooked all the time when patients come to me, whether they're a doctor or their gastroenterologist or another practitioner, whatever, would be adequate production and release of digestive enzymes from the pancreas. Elastase 1, pancreatic elastase. Like, I am looking for that so, so carefully. And if I see anything below 200, to me, that's a referral back to the GP. We want to know if there's something going on with the pancreas, which it rarely is it pancreatite? Like, what's going on there? And then if it's not, see if they have access to a good, strong, you know, script-based enzyme. Creon, it's not the cleanest product, but I've just seen I've seen complete resolution of symptoms when people who need something like Creon get on that product.
Okay.
So that's big. Yeah, proper bile flow, it's a little bit trickier. You know, secondary bile acids can be antifungal. Have you seen that too?
Yeah, so I read a lot of research about that and I found that really, really exciting. The bile acids actually function as an antifungal, because I feel like a lot of, and the bile acids actually help shape our microbiome, right, I think? So
yeah,
I feel like a lot of people have issues with bile acid production, and I know a lot of patients have like bile acid diarrhea and things like that. So I was wondering if there was some sort of pattern there.
That's right. Yeah, it's a tricky one, exactly. So like the bile acid diarrhea, maybe that's malabsorption, and we think about leaky gut and lacteals. It's a whole kind of, you know, in inflammation and gut damage piece there. But I agree. I'm 100. I mean, it's right up there with the pancreatic elastase. If people are having trouble with bile flow, you would expect to see dysbiosis, and fungal overgrowth would just be part of that. Motility is massive. The only real way that we can test that in the clinic would be like mouth to toilet bowl. This is a massive kind of nod to Dr. Horlack. He's just been so helpful in my understanding here, and just like drilled into me, like, if motility is not happening, all bets are off, and you gotta fix that as a primary piece.
And so with that mouth to bowel, is that like, would you be doing the corn test or something like that?
Corn test. I like sesame seeds, and patient of mine that either couldn't tolerate those or didn't want to. She was like a researcher. She was great. And she went and found a study where they did these like muffins that were dyed blue, and they would stain her bowels blue. So she'd come back with this, gut transit time test approach, which is great.
Oh, that's
really
so
cool.
Funny. Did she have blue stools then, I'm guessing?
Blue stools.
Yeah. You could test that out using the charcoal bread. I tried that out not long ago.
Big time. Maybe that's a bit constipating. So,
yes.
And same with beets, right? So like beets can speed it up a bit. So, but it's global, right? Like even if it's delayed by, 6 hours or 12 hours, it's still going to give us a really good kind of starting place. Then the last big piece, which isn't really, I mean, so far we've been talking a lot about the small bowel, which is all about motility and digestion, absorption, the breakdown. It's like the engine room of the gut. If you're moving over to the large bowel, I think that comes back to your short chain fatty acid production and butyrate.
Fantastic. So tell me then, so we're increasing stomach acid, we're ensuring that the bowel motility is happening. What about then dysbiosis and things like that?
As in bacterial dysbiosis?
Would you be using probiotics and
Big time. That's
things
right.
Like that?
Exactly. Yeah, for sure. What are we doing? Yeah, that's the kind of the aims. How do we do it?
Yeah.
I get you. So big ones, top of the pile, and something that I see our industry moving away from. Totally understand why, practitioners don't use it, but I am like so deep into tinctures, herbal tinctures. And we've actually, thanks to another mentor of mine, Val Ivosco, he's taught me back in the day, we're talking, you know, years and years ago, how to manufacture herbal tinctures from scratch with raw bulk herbs. That basically just opens up this kind of whole materia medica. You know, we can sample from Ayurveda and traditional Chinese medicine, and, you know, whatever's kind of available here in Australia, we can turn into strong, strong herbal tinctures. That's the number one feedback I get from patients. They're like, yeah, I've done tinctures, no problem. And then you see them a month later and they're like, man, these tinctures are so strong. They're hard to choke down.
Which are your favorite? Which are your favorite tinctures to use for fungal overgrowth? Do you use much? I guess when I was at uni, we were taught Pau Darko, Horopito, but do you have other favorites?
Yeah, big time. Yeah, Pau Darko, I'll use that as like a second line approach. I don't love it for fungal overgrowth, but I have seen improvements. Horopito is like top of the pile. Polygodial, that's the active constituent in there. There's not a heap of research on it, but it doesn't really matter to me. It's safe. It's got traditional history to it with the Maoris, and it is like a candida crusher, particularly absolutely.
I love that. Huge. Candida crusher.
Yeah, big time. kind of pretty typical ones that everyone will be working with, oregano leaf, oregano oil. Oil is definitely the stronger approach, so I limit my timeline on that. Same with clove. You've got the eugenol. That's also a pretty potent biofilm disruptor. That's a terpene.
So when you limit your timing on those, because I am a little bit afraid of using oregano and things like that, I tend to not use those. How long should practitioners be using those for?
Yeah, good point. I was the same. I actually didn't use oregano oil for years until I found that I kind of needed to. Patients weren't getting better, basically. And so for me, and that's where it comes back to me being like a clinician, it's like, you know, they're sitting in front of you and they're like, I've been doing this program and it's not working. And so we said, okay, look, let's kind of ratchet up the intensity. And it's a massive, massive win for a lot of people. So I like capsule-based oregano oil. I don't love the drops unless you're dealing with that oral or esophageal thrush. Then you work a little bit more towards those drops. And I would limit it to a month. I would keep it at a month for most people. Always there's, you know, the exceptions to the rule, and they've been unwell for 30 years and they're like, man, I finally got my life back. We say, look, run it, lower the dose and run it for another month just to make sure you don't regress. That just breaks my heart. Like if patients are better and you say, okay, great, go and live your best life, and they come back 2 months later and they're back to square one. It's something I want to avoid at all costs.
Why do you think that happens? Like what causes that regression, do you think?
Yeah, it depends on the root cause. Yeah, it depends on what led them there. So with fungal, if you think about what set them up, like a disrupted gut, antibiotics basically is a huge one, but there's a million other disruptions to the gut. Like how can we got to do our best 110% effort at rebalancing that so that it can kind of fly on its own and we can pull away on these support structures like herbs, prebiotics, probiotics, and then some advanced therapies. Really big advanced therapies would be things like fatty acid fractions.
Okay, I haven't heard of those. Tell me more.
Yeah. Just before we move on, I just wanted to mention Galangal is standing out. Are you familiar with Galangal?
Yeah, it's in all the stir fry, like soups and...
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. So I had that pigeonholed, so funny, as a, it's like a relative of ginger and kind of maybe does the same carminative and prokinetic and circulatory stimulant. But Galangal is like a standout frontline antifungal, especially against aspergillosis. So that aspergillus kind of overgrowth. It's huge. Yeah, it's really big.
And are you using that in tincture or food as medicine or?
Yeah, good point. Yeah, initially I'd use it as tincture. So because for me, I want to kind of be aware of and adjust the dose accordingly. But once someone, and I like that input, once someone gets better, you know, go eat some Thai soup once a week, whatever, you know, get involved, develop a relationship with this plant as part of your kind of stay well strategy.
And then what about cinnamon and things like that. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, Verum, Cassia, both of them are potent antifungals. That's like the true cinnamon of the Chinese cinnamon.
Mm.
Don't have a huge concern. I see a little bit of talk around Chinese cinnamon, being possibly toxic. I think it's been used for too long for us to be, that concerned. Mm. I'm hearing a lot of kind of bad talk about licorice at the moment. I really like Simon Mills. He's just like, I prescribe licorice by the gallons each month. Like, traditional cultures have been using this for longer than you can kind of shake a stick at. We don't have to be afraid of these herbs.
Yeah. So, licorice, I had no idea till I was reading your website that it is an antifungal. I know it well for its adrenal action, but I had no idea that it was an antifungal.
Yeah. And it's a synergizer. It's very sweet. So a lot of people kind of taste these, and I normally don't go too high dose on licorice. I kind of take a page out of, classical Chinese medicine. They're using a lot of these licorice as these low dose synergizers and basically also helps tinctures mix, but that's like neither here nor there. And then the other really big one, which is just starting to kind of come on to naturopathic scene over the past 5 or 10 years, would be magnolia bark. Mm. This one is major. I've been using it a lot as a prokinetic, so kind of stimulating gut motility, but it's also got a huge amount of research supporting its use to inhibit like candida's adhesion to the gut and that transition. Like, whatever we can do to block candida from converting from that unicellular yeast to the hypo form is huge. And then biofilm formation. Magnolia bark can block biofilm formation by candida.
Wow. So if you were making a mix for someone that presented with small intestinal fungal overgrowth, generally and I know you're changing like lifestyle and all that sort of stuff too, but how long do your patients use? I know this is like a really big question. I don't know if you'll be able to answer it because everyone's so different, right, with our patients, but how long do people usually have to stay on herbs for fungal overgrowth?
Yeah, for sure. If it's a simple case, like, I don't see a whole lot of simple cases anymore. A lot of the patients that I'm, like, the longer you do it, I'm always kind of laughing with colleagues. If you do this for a while, the people that are kind of attracted to you, they become harder and harder.
Yeah.
And so I'll look back at when I first started, I'm like, oh my God, those were just like a walk in the park.
Yeah.
And then now they've explored everything. They're going this way and ozone therapy, and they're on multiple drugs. Like, there's a whole bunch of confounding factors.
Yeah.
But if it's a simple case, they're bloated and distended, maybe a bit of joint pain, I would be looking for 10 weeks as the overall intervention, and about halfway through, I would be chopping and changing the plan depending on progress. If someone's saying, I'm feeling like $1 million, I would just keep it exactly the same and I would run it. And I've become very conservative there. Some new patients are a little bit surprised. They say, look, I'm feeling better. I'm 100%. I'll see you never. If we can just push it a little bit longer, I don't want to see you come back, because we'll have to build it all back up from square one. And just that little bit more. Let's keep you feeling good.
Yeah.
So let's treat just a bit longer to sustain the improvements.
Yeah. Oh, you're very funny. So I feel like that's a really good list of different herbs for everyone to consider, and lots of ones that I would never have even thought of for fungal overgrowth. What about probiotics and things like that? I think everyone's familiar with Saccharomyces boulardii as a type of yeast to treat yeast. Often people are a little bit confused about this. Can you tell us more about it? Because it's such a great I call it a probiotic, but it's like a yeast-based probiotic. It's so great to use for stuff like this, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. It's top of the pile for me. Saccharomyces boulardii, or SB, I use high doses. I'm a little bit cautious around people who are constipated.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've... Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So it can slow things down. It can bind things up. But the really interesting thing about Saccharomyces boulardii, More when you're tipping over into the mycotoxin side of things is, among other probiotics, Saccharomyces boulardii is also a reasonably, I don't want to say potent, but it's a reasonable binder. And so what Saccharomyces boulardii, SB, can do is just kind of open up that door and start to kind of eliminate, get that program starting to work, get those wheels turning. It can impact its ability to form filaments and biofilms, and then it can also secrete, and I don't know if this is strain specific, so I'm cautious to say it, but Saccharomyces boulardii can also secrete capric acid, which is a medium chain fatty acid, and a lot of these kind of fatty acids are antifungal, so we're mentioning things like coconut oil and MCT. I don't find, I mean, maybe MCT, but I find you really need to ramp it up. So things like undecylinic acid, that's like a castor oil fraction, and caprylic acid specifically, even monolaurin, they're all things that I'd layer on. I wouldn't look, and I see this, people do this, they come to me and they've done this, and this is where I think people can go wrong. They might have just done the fatty acids to treat a fungal overgrowth, and I don't think on its own it would treat a significant overgrowth. But as an additional layer, I've seen that just supercharge probiotics, her antifungal herbal medicines, and then the prebiotics are a nice little kind of support to get that microbiome back in fighting shape.
Great. So going back to the SB, you said that it inhibits biofilm formation, and prevents adhesion to the gut epithelium, I think, and it reduces inflammation. What sort of dose? I'm so interested in SB. I'm wondering what sort of dose that you do and for how long again?
Yeah, absolutely. So the really big one, and I like these kind of products that are higher. I do go high dose. So that's kind of, I'm not that I'm not afraid to go high dose. The patient will tell me if it's too high dose. And then we say, look, just ease into it. I always say with my new patients, ease into it, get comfy, ramp it up, look for benefits over a month of the timeline. Everyone wants to get the better, you know, in a week or two. I had a new patient and he's emailing me. He's been unwell for 5 years. So like, I'm not feeling any better.
Yeah.
He's like 2 weeks into treatment. It's going to take a bit of time to turn the ship. So I like 500 milligrams of SB twice a day for as a strong intervention. And then once everything's moving in the right direction, my approach is to, instead of cold turkey, pull people off, I would just drop the dose, run it for another, and that would be something like 2 months if you drop the dose. So they'll be on something like Saccharomyces boulardii, as long as they're feeling better on it, for close to 3 months, most patients.
Yeah, lovely. And then we know that it's really important for that intestinal epithelial lining and everything. So just such a fantastic product or nutrient, really. So what about the other prebiotics you mentioned? Do you find, I mean, I'd love to know what you're using, and also if you find that they aggravate people who have candida, like if they're finding that they're more gassy and more bloated and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I love prebiotics. Again, this is from Dr. Horlock, who's kind of, you know,
the guru.
Reduce the fear, the guru, exactly. I mean, you can't go much. He's a total trailblazer, 20 years ahead of everyone else. But I use just a heck of a lot of partially hydrolyzed guar gum. It's frontline therapy. Sometimes patients come to me and they say, look, I've done it. Either it wore off or it didn't work. And what I've learned over years of using that product is, this is clinical, I haven't found any data here. It kind of seems to do what it does, and then people get to a certain stage where it's not doing any more. And so we say, okay, look, that's the laws of diminishing returns. Let's phase you off this. Let's look for something broader in terms of that, like, fermentation profile. PHGG is very targeted. It's low FODMAP, and it's a very slow-burning prebiotic. If you compare that, everyone, for good reason, is pretty turned off by things like inulin and FOS, and even, you know, certain GOS products can do this for certain people. But that's because specifically inulin it'll, and lactulose as well, it'll burn immediately. Like it hits the proximal large bowel and the beneficial bugs throw a party, they ferment it, they produce gas, get abdominal pain, get bloating. And to me, that's going in too fast. So if someone comes to me and they're on something like inulin or FOS or GOS, less commonly on lactulose, which is relevant but harder to use, and they feel good, great, keep them on it. If they're like, I'm bloated and I'm gassy, I'll pull them off of it and we'll introduce something like partially hydrolyzed guar gum. Acacia fiber is the same. I find acacia fiber tends to slow things down. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing depends on the patient. And then if we're looking to broaden it out a little bit, that's when people are feeling better. And it's a huge milestone in the case where they've gone through active treatment, they want to lock in the changes, and we look to expand it. So I could definitely do a lot more with food as medicine there, but I'll normally recommend like a combo product that has a little bit of a broader piece to it, something like green banana flour or, you know, the oat beta-glucans or something.
So with, because I'm thinking about a patient I've got at the moment, and she said, oh, I've stopped the PHDG, I got tired of it. I was like, no, it's a long-term thing. You can't just stop and start. But how long are you doing the PHDG for? And again, I'm interested in your dosing.
Yeah, so I like a tablespoon a day. I think that's around 6 grams a day. I have seen going up, doubling that AM and PM in treatment resistant, or if they need a nudge. I had a patient who did that by accident and like almost cured his SIBO, like treatment resistant SIBO that wouldn't shift. And then he dropped down to half dose and it all kind of came back, crashing back down. But normally I do about a tablespoon a day, 6 grams. And I am pretty open-ended about it. Again, if it's treatment resistant and these people have been unwell for a long time, I've seen enough of patients that have dropped it at a certain point and seen regression just to say, look, if you're better, stay on it. Indefinite's probably too strong a word, but I'm happy with people on it long term. No problem.
Okay, good to know.
Yeah, you take it until you don't need it.
Now, what about liposomal glutathione? Because I don't know much about it. I haven't used it, but I have read that it's quite good for reducing fungal resistance.
Interesting. Okay, yeah, very interesting. I haven't seen that piece.
Okay.
I do like glutathione and I do like N-acetylcysteine for different reasons. And then the really big piece there is you do see a lot of either depleted glutathione stores that would be on oat testing, or the other one would be like an upregulation of the CBS enzyme. So basically for me, if that's functional, like if that's not genetic and your CBS enzyme is running red hot, it's the body making a decision. Do we want to methylate at this little juncture around homocysteine, or do we want to produce glutathione? And if it's saying, give me all the glutathione I can get, then it's pulling, and that's, you know, the kind of the weight on your biochemistry. It's pulling everything away from making you feel better by methylating, detoxing hormones, like all the great stuff, rebuilding and repairing cells, everything methylation does, to putting out that oxidative fire with glutathione. You see a lot of glutathione conjugation, not a lot, you see some glutathione conjugation with mycotoxin detox. And then the really big phase two, which I don't use, I should use it more, would be glucuronidation. Most mycotoxins get detoxed through glucuronidation.
Okay, interesting. So supporting that liver is very important. Okay.
Big time. Yeah, and you look broad. I mean, I think that's the big thing. All these tools, these are all tools and, you know, in the kind of toolbox. But if you look broadly, what's the patient presenting with? What are the symptoms that are slowing down? What's the history? What was that never been well since moment?
Yeah.
If a patient knows that, that's half the battle. Like, that's what went wrong. Here's everything that we can do to get them better. And then once they're better, lock in the changes. I mean, a huge, huge kind of game-changing addition to the practice a few years ago was were postbiotics. Have you guys done much? Have you looked into butyrate supplementation?
Yes, I had the other gut expert, bacterial aspect, Dr. Brad Leach, and he's really into butyrate, and so I have massive. Also become really excited about it too.
Oh, massive. Yeah, game
I feel like
changer.
A total nerd. I'm interested in butyrate.
yeah, exactly. That's right. And so, you know, just giving the body what it needs. So I think kind of like teach a person to fish, you'd be supplementing with fermentable fibers. That sometimes doesn't do what it's supposed to do, whether the gut's too dysregulated for whatever reason. Just feed a person a fish, give the body butyrate, see what changes. And I've seen miracles in very chronic and persistent cases.
Oh, I love that. You're just describing such a holistic approach to management of this. Okay, one last question, and it's around diet. You know, even now, literally like 2 weeks ago, I had a patient present with, she's put herself on an anti-candida diet. And it is the old anti-candida diet of the early 90s, where it was no melon, no mushroom, no fruit and so on. And, you know, I was kind of like, oh my God, no. I'm interested though, that's just my opinion. But for you, what are your thoughts on optimal diet for managing candida? Is there an optimal diet even?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I don't want to say I'm hands-off around the diet, but I mean, for most conditions, that's not quite true, but for most digestive conditions, I don't think elimination diets are curative. And I think a lot of patients, and maybe practitioners, you're seeing that less so now, I think some patients look at it as curative. So, for example, with your patient on, you know, the old-fashioned candida diet, they're probably thinking this is going to do it. And I have not seen that play out. That would be the major, major exception to the rule. I'd be surprised if that worked. And so what I like to do, whole foods diet, don't eat junk. I mean, that's pretty simple. None of my patients are doing that really. And then we want to limit even some of those. I mean, definitely refined carbs. Some of those simple sugars are really big. And then what I do is I'll push in deeper if things aren't going according to plan, and we'll start cutting things out. I had this patient, candida, you know, well, I said candida, it was an oat test, so definite fungal, definite oxalates, pretty much had him better. He was feeling great, digestive symptoms had almost resolved, and then mango season came in, and he was eating a crate of mangoes a month or whatever, and pretty big regression, and then we had to build it back up. So whatever we can do to limit that, speed up your program. But I just like to meet patients where there are. A lot of my patients, they don't obviously, no one loves restrictive diets, but some of them have actually been traumatized by restrictive diets. Practitioners saying, you got to do it harder, you got to cut out more, you got to cut. And then they get a bit of food phobia. And I think that's pretty hard to work with.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. Thank you, Todd. Thank you so much for joining us.
No worries.
Yeah, your knowledge has just been fantastic. And it's, as I said, it's a topic I've been wanting to discuss for such a long time. And you've just provided such an insightful discussion with so many great clinical insights for us to action straight away. And most of all, I think for me, you've really shown that it's that really holistic approach we want to apply rather than that reductionist framework of just using antifungals. We really need to understand and address what's going on for our patients. So thank you.
Yeah, pleasure. It's really great to be here.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us today. The key points I have taken from this discussion are the candida crusher, or a pito, definitely going to try that one. Saccharomyces SB, of course, for everything inhibiting candida biofilm formation, preventing adhesion to those epithelial gut cells, reducing inflammatory cytokines released by the yeast. And of course, checking out the OATS test to really hone in on what's going on with our patient along with our case taking. Thank you everyone for listening today. Don't forget you can find all the show notes, transcripts and other resources from today's episode on the FX Medicine website. I'm Lisa Costa-Beer and thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.
This podcast is intended as healthcare practitioner education only, and it is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to FX Medicine, and share us with your family, friends, and colleagues.